The first case in our calendar is 95-1139, Robert Gorey Jr. versus Johnston Coca-Cola Bottling Group. Mr. Holmes.
May it please the court, my learned opponents. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes if I could. Robert Gorey, age 27, had been employed with Johnston Coke for 4 years. He was provided a company car. He was told he had full insurance coverage. He could use the car on a 24-hour basis. On December 12, 1990, while driving his car, he was struck by an uninsured motorist. Bob suffered serious bodily injuries, resulting in a hip replacement. He could not work for 3 years. On January 8, 1991, Bob's attorney submitted a UM claim. 2 days later, on January 10, 1991, approximately 30 days after the accident, Bob's company, through its authorized agent, John Raines, signed a rejection of UM coverage for the policy period in question, which started on November 1 of 1990 and went through 11-1 of 91. That was issued by Appley Lumberman's Insurance Company, referred to in the brief as policy number 01. A complaint was filed, discovery started.
We've read all the briefs and all those facts. Let's go right to the law. What's your best case and or your best reason that rejection of UM coverage must be right?
Your Honor, the best case scenario for that is that this court, starting with the Abate case in 1970, the Bolton case in 1978, held that the rejection must be expressed, cannot be implied. What is an express rejection is the question. This court repeatedly in cases have held that a policy must be in effect at the time of the loss. We cannot retroactively do things and affect coverage. The statute makes it mandatory that there be U.S. coverage on all policies issued in this state unless there is a rejection. The statute is silent as to the manner of rejection. This court today can decide whether or not the facts of Gorey constitute a sufficient rejection under the current law, or can go a step further and require that with commercial insurers and with commercial carriers, that the expressed rejection, okay, as Justice Corrigan said in 1970 in Abate, be overt, that it be specific, that it be before the loss. And if we're talking about a specific...
Counsel, in this case, your argument might be more persuasive in a case where there was some level of doubt, but isn't there agreement on both the part of the insured and the insurer here that they wish to reject coverage?
That sounds very similar to the case that I think Justice Cook decided at the Court of Appeals level on Celia, where he found that the stuffer was sufficient. And a case came up here, and although the case was denied as improvidently filed, the concurring decision of Justice Douglas and the dissent of Justice Sweeney, I think, are very articulate in that the statute requires that there be equivalent coverage offered. And in the Celia case, there wasn't equivalent coverage. And in the case, Justice Sweeney in the dissent argued that you could not have an intelligent rejection until there was an offer. So we know that the Court of Appeals in Franklin County and Atwood, Court of Appeals in Lucas County in the Kmeyer case, in both of those cases, we have insureds that specifically requested a specific type of coverage. And in Kmeyer, our own district, decided within a year of the Gorey case. In that particular case, the insured, as its president, had an attorney, 20 years experience with insurance law, said, this is what I want. I want UM coverage, $25,000. I want liability coverage far greater. And the court, in a well-reasoned decision, said, no, that doesn't satisfy the requirements that you have equivalent coverage. So we get back to what Justice Douglas says. What we want in this particular case is to examine what is sufficient. What we have here is people who have, after the fact, with memories, going back and trying to determine, okay, what happened, okay? What we have are people making a decision that all have a vested interest.
Well, there's a fair amount of documentation also. It wasn't just people trying to remember what they said or did, but it was documented.
Well, Your Honor, if I may just be responding to that this way. There were specifications. We know specifications at the lower courts have not been enough to satisfy the rejection requirement. And that's the cases I cited a few minutes ago. We know that the affidavits were filed after the fact. We know that there was this rejection of the year before's policy 4 months after the accident, policy 00. Okay, so the first time Lumbermans offered coverage was for the year before, and they never received a rejection back before this loss. The second year of the coverage, they got the rejection back after the loss. So the question is whether there's some documentation, but specification should not be enough given the fact that the statute mandates an offer. In fact, it's even more than that. It says that there should be coverage issued by all insurance companies on all policies written in this state.
There's so much litigation in this area, and we're always coming to determination of facts, and as you said, after the fact, and trying to revive past recollections. Isn't that probably a very strong reason in order to avoid all this litigation, simply to require it to be in writing?
You know, I think it is, and if I may, that in our brief we set forth that there's no state Supreme Court in the United States that has said oral rejection is enough. None. 30 states require a writing. 17 states don't even allow
rejection. Well, most state statutes require a writing. Ours does not. Doesn't that make us different?
Our state statute just says rejection. This
right.
Court said on two prior occasions, express, not imply. What is express? Are we going to take a look at what this court did a month ago on Burgess and said that we have to have independent third-party evidence to support when there's a no-contact UM case as to protect the insurance company from fraud? When we have this case, which is the reciprocal, where we have the mandated requirement by the statute, and the people that are all talking about it after the fact have vested interest, the insured has a $500,000 deductible, so they lose $500,000. The insurance company, of course, is providing the coverage, and the broker has an account that's the second largest bottler in the United States. The broker has a vested interest to keep this particular account. You know,
the thing that I'm concerned with is that there is evidence sufficient in the record to show that the agent, who I assume is speaking for the insured, says that I've discussed this with him. He doesn't want uninsured motorists. He's never wanted uninsured motorists, and we don't want it now. How are we to treat that relationship between the insured and the agent?
The statute doesn't say anything about an exception if there's an agent involved. That's the only difference in this case from the K-Miner case.
Well, can't we assume that in speaking with the agent, the insurance company is speaking with the insured about that relationship?
We certainly can assume that, and we can certainly look at the statute and say that the insurance company should still make an offer equal to. And it did not in this case, either in the National Union policy nor in the Lumbermen's policy. There was never an offer. It came the other way. This is what we want. But there was never an explanation. So how can you have a rational decision unless you know the terms of the UM coverage, its cost, its provisions, etc.? And that's where I think we have a whittling away effect, if in fact we allow that to happen in this particular case.
Can we go on the past indications of the insured by rejection to indicate that his intentions in the policy year that we're discussing were rejection, was rejection?
I think that's an excellent point, because every year the insured with other insurance companies used a written rejection form to reject. The first year that Lumbermans was the insurance company was the year before the accident, for which there wasn't the rejection before the loss. And then the year of the accident, where the rejection was immediately after the loss.
But doesn't the statute address or go to the intent of the insured and what coverage the insured wanted? Can't you take other than conversation? conversations with the insured, the insured's actions of prior rejections into account?
The statute certainly has as its purpose to protect people who are injured as a result of uninsured drivers. And when we talk about the intent, the statute requires that each insurance company issuing a policy offer equal coverage. Lumbermen's for the first time offered coverage the year before, and the statute creates an exception if, in fact, Lumbermen's have been insuring the insured prior and there had been a rejection. But there wasn't that issue in this case. Had Lumbermen's the year before obtained a rejection, we wouldn't be here today. But they haven't, because the evidence would not have supported that there was a writing from the insured, as the statute calls for, asking about UM coverage. Since it was a new coverage with Lumbermen's and new coverage with National Union, it's our position that the purpose of the statute would be frustrated if, in fact, there wasn't the offer and a rejection.
Didn't the insured's primary insurer on UM coverage originally support your position? I think it was State Farm, wasn't it?
The State Farm versus, I'm not sure, I'm sure the second one. Which case are you referring to?
In your case, didn't you get uninsured motorist coverage from your primary carrier?
Oh, yes, Your Honor, we did.
And didn't they support their right of subrogation against these other policies on the basis there was no rejection?
Yes, they did, Your Honor. Excuse me.
And what happened to them on the appeal? They sort of disappeared.
They never went any further with regard to it, Your Honor. Never did. So coming back to what this court can do, it can protect all employees in Ohio, blue-collar, white-collar, collective bargaining employees, non-collective bargaining employees, from situations like this case by simply requiring that the insured, corpus insured, issue a written rejection. And that follows the express rejection, the overt act that this court has said before. It's just interpreting the statute and saying, what's wrong with that? Why can't a sophisticated corporate insurer, whether it be a letter, whether it be a facsimile, doesn't make any difference what form it
is. Was there evidence here that the employee involved thought that he was covered with uninsured motors?
Yes, Your Honor.
What, based on what?
Based on what he was told when he took the job. He had full coverage. He was never told that they didn't have coverage for uninsured motors, which had an effect on what kind of coverage he may buy.
Well, he never had it, though, did he? I mean, this happened in a year after, sometime after he was hired.
Four years after he was hired. And he had that coverage with State Farm, which was totally inadequate, because he thought he had plenty of coverage here. And he didn't, of course. National Union, if I may add, never, by their own admission of Mr. Rudd, never made an offer of uninsured motorist in this particular case. And there certainly was no rejection in this particular case. We think that public policy is, as Justice Resnick said, is best served that we don't have to go through on a case-by-case basis. That this court follow Justice Gordon, follow the 78 court, and decide what an express rejection is. And simply, quite simply, it should be something specific.
Well, it's tempting to say that this should be in writing, as many states have, but our General Assembly didn't do that, did they? They know how to write that language in. If they felt it was important that it be in writing, wouldn't we be adding? Wouldn't we be rewriting the statute if we did that?
You would not be writing any more than Justice Corrigan did, or the 78 court did, when it said express. The word express is not in the statute either. The implied rejections are not accepted. And certainly you can interpret what express means, an overt act. And to do that, in my opinion, it's not legislating, it's not a separation of powers issue, it's an interpretation. This court must do it in many, many cases. This court has done that repeatedly with contractual restrictions, where companies try to restrict UM coverage.
Counsel, given the Justice Corrigan's language that you referred to, that express, doesn't this mean that even if we were, you know, in this case, these parties, doesn't the direction to the broker that we want, you know, whatever the minimum we can get in any state, we know UM if we can avoid it, doesn't that exact exactly meet the definition of express. It may not be right, but there's an expression of intent.
I'd like to answer that two ways. First of all, if you take a look at the specifications for Ohio, it said statutory. So that requires an interpretation of what they meant by statutory, okay? So are we to accept the insurance company's interpretation of statutory, or are we to ask the insurance company to be very specific and say what they want to do? As far as their expressed intention as to what they wanted to do, that flies right in the face of the purpose of the statute, right in the face of requiring equal coverage, unless, okay, there is eliminated coverage.
The purpose of the statute really, I think, as Sweeney points out, the purpose of the statute is to make sure that folks know that they have this right to coverage. And there isn't any doubt in this case, is there, that the folks participating in this deal do?
You know, it's an interesting argument about the sophistication of the buyer. There's no evidence as to how sophisticated anybody was in this particular case. Certainly, Lumberman's was desperate in April by saying, in a facsimile, better get back to us that rejection, that form from the 89-90 year. We got good reason to do it. Lumberman's knew, and the burden was on the insurance company to get a rejection back. There was certainly a question in Patricia Gary's mind when she sent that facsimile, and she wanted that rejection back. So I think there is clearly a question raised at that juncture in time about whether there was a rejection right by Lumberman's own representative. Thank you, if I get your time.
Thank you, Mr. Holmes. Mr. Sanderson.
May I please report? Counsel. My name is Mike Sanderson. I represent the Appalachian Lumberman's Mutual Casualty Company. I'm going to address Janik and I are going to split the time, and I'm going to address primarily or solely, unless requested otherwise, to the rejection issue, which is the only assignment of error against Lumberman's as to whether there should be a rejection in writing. Mr. Janik will speak further about the offer issue, which is the assignment solely against his client. What we have is appellant coming to this court, essentially asking this court to disregard express wording of the statute. The numerous courts of appeals in Ohio that have held that you don't have to have a written rejection. The evidence from the other jurisdictions would show that where there is the requirement of a writing, that it's by express wording of the statute. And the decisions from Supreme Courts of other states before the statutes were amended, three of them to be exact, that we cited West Virginia, Florida, and Washington, which held that under similar statutes at that time, there was not a requirement for the rejection being right. We believe that the clear language of the statute twice uses the phrase in writing, talking about when you want to change your coverage or add additional coverage once you once rejected it. But most importantly, when it first talks about accepting or rejecting, there is no reference whatsoever to the word writing. If the legislature wanted to have it in writing, it could have easily inserted the word in writing like it did twice two other places in the same statute.
What's your response, Councilman? Why it would be much simpler and better write my rule for this court to adopt the writing
statute? That is maybe a teasing question as far as why couldn't you resolve all this once and for all? Mm-hmm. I don't think you would, though, because first off, in this case, if you were to follow that reasoning in this case, you would still hold in favor of Lumberman's, because there are numerous writings issued contemporaneously or prior to the effective date of the policy, November 1st, expressing the insurer's intent to reject UM coverage, including the specifications and the binder written by the agent for the insurer, which stated statutory minimum limit of liability afforded only in states where rejection of coverage is not permitted by law. So even if we're just told and go only that far saying there should be a writing, Lumberman still would prevail on the evidence in this case. I don't think, though, that it would resolve your problems or your questions and that would come up to this court repeatedly. Questions would arise then, what is the role of an agent? Does that be signed or just in writing? We have written evidence here, nothing signed for the fact that we have ample and conclusive written evidence. What form would it have to take? Need to be signed by all named insureds? Only one? What would be the language that would be necessary? What would be included in the writing? If you had a pre-printed form writing in this current case, like some regulations that have been enacted in other states.
But the insurance company in this case felt it would be better to have something in writing, didn't it?
Are you referring to the underwriting guidelines, Your Honor? I believe those underwriting guidelines are written for all 50 states, and there are numerous states where that's required.
Didn't he press them to get some writing showing that he rejected this? That they felt that to make sure and to be explicit that the rejection should be in writing.
The insurance company, of course, would like to have it in writing.
Well, then why not make them have it in writing?
It's analogous to saying, because my law firm might want me to file appeals 3 days early, I should be held to that as a matter of law to some extent. The law has a requirement that there be express overt acts. A private company may well go beyond that in its own internal policies to try to avoid exactly situations like this where they have to argue up to the Supreme Court of the state something that is clear by the intent of the parties in the testimony.
Well, a question that bothers me is that who is the agent of? Does he have more allegiance to the insurance companies that he writes insurance for, or more allegiance to the insured, the one insured that he has a policy with? Who can he more easily move? The insurance company as his agent, or the insured, the one insured? Where does his allegiance lie?
It's an interesting question, Your Honor. It depends on whether you're talking about an independent broker, as we have in this case, or maybe an agent that's only writing for a couple of companies. In this case, we have a national broker out of Chicago. The broker is hired, retained, and works for the insured. Once the policy has been decided as to where the policy will be placed, the broker also becomes a receiving agent by law for the insurer, and as Judge Scowl described in his opinion, he covered this, there's this dual agency with a limited role for the insurer as far as getting documents from the insurer. But the primary focus, the primary concern of an independent broker like Rollins, Bird, and Connor, as testified to by the Vice President George Gordy, is to their insured. They are working for the insured and soliciting insurance from all over the market. There's no allegiance to Kemper here.
An independent broker is just as good as the number of insurance companies he has to go to.
A national independent broker can go to any company. They're all, when you're talking about a national account of this size, you can pretty much pick where you want to go ahead and receive your proposals from. Anyone would be happy to write a proposal for this type of insurance.
The agent wants to keep all those insurance companies happy with them because he wants to get the best deal for his insurers.
I believe that with this type of situation where you have the size of the insurer, the size of the broker, and the insurance companies, that we're not having any type of influence being imposed from the insurance company. Rather, the insurer and its broker really are the ones driving the bus as far as what they want even in the policy language, and where they're going to go ahead and place the insurance. This is not like, you know, you or I going to the local State Farm agent going right to State Farm.
Well, in this case, if the broker wanted to keep the insurance company happy, he would have written UM coverage. They get a premium for UM coverage. Wouldn't he have been more inclined to write this spec differently, or try to encourage the client to write it differently?
That's a good point, Your Honor. There would be a premium for the UM coverage. And if I was here arguing on behalf of lumbermen to collect UM coverage under the intent of these policies, I'd be laughed out because it's so clear. But the broker has allegiance to the insured, and the insured's intent was clear here. And Mr. Cordy testified, it's in the record in his deposition, that they would not accept. If the proposals had come back specifying UM coverage, he would have sent it back to him and said, rewrite it. That's not what we want. That's not what we discussed when we went over these forms. That's not what we discussed when we went over the specifications.
That's not in the record, is it? I mean, you're speculating.
No, you know, that is in the record, in the deposition testimony, Mr. George Corey, the vice president of Brownsburg and Connor, said that if it came back with UM coverage in this proposal in response to my specifications, I would have thrown it out and told to rewrite it.
Council, is there a disagreement that the employer told the employee that he had his car for his personal use as well as business use, and that it was covered by the policy of full coverage of insurance?
Your Honor, that is a question that was never addressed in any kind of factual scenario besides what I would view to be a somewhat self-serving affidavit submitted by counsel.
Was there a dispute?
Johnston was dismissed from the case before that point. No one ever discussed that with Johnston. The concern of Judge Scala, maybe the concern of Mr. Gorey, was a claim against his employer, but he didn't pursue that claim. And maybe if there's a policy issue here, it should be that the legislature should require employers to protect their employees by carrying the UM coverage for these kind of situations. But that's not the issue with the insurance companies, who weren't part of that employment relationship, weren't part of those discussions, weren't part of any collective bargaining. That simply would be a beef that Mr. Corey would have with his employer, which has not been pursued, and no one has ever done anything regarding a factual record for that.
Well, it would be fair to say this is not a full coverage policy.
I don't know, Your Honor. A full coverage policy may be a full coverage as far as liability, collision. Many people believe they have full coverage, but reject or carry very limited UM. If I could, my counsel over here is waiting to end his time. I'd like to
take that. Thank you, Mr. Sanderson. Mr. Janik.
Respectfully submits that it is time to put to rest the issues concerning the offering of UM coverage in motor vehicle policies by holding that 39.37.18 means exactly what it says. UM coverage is automatic in every policy of motor vehicle insurance without necessity of formality of offer and acceptance unless specifically rejected by the name insured. Automatic coverage is consistent with the clear language of 39.37.18, which requires uninsured motorist coverage in every policy of insurance. It is also consistent with the rulings of this court in Abate, which recognized not only that the statute was mandatory, but in fact that the language was imperative in requiring this coverage.
So UM coverage was offered by your company?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that UM coverage is in place unless rejected either by operation of law or if the court were to deem an offer requirement imposed on the statute.
What was the quote for the UM coverage?
The UM coverage was rejected, Your Honor. It was not quoted. And looking to that, Your Honor, no magic words were utilized by National Union. We offer you UM coverage. That is clear and is undisputed by National Union. If the court were to look at an offer requirement, National Union would respectfully submit that requirement should be viewed in a totality of the evidence scenario as to whether there was a meeting of the minds on the parties as to the issue of UM coverage and whether or not there was rejection of that coverage in accordance with the standards held by this court in the 80 case and by the court's appeals. Was the insured aware of UM coverage? Did the insured understand the protection that was afforded? And did the insured reject us? And in this situation, there is a meeting of the minds. And that if there is an offer requirement, it was satisfied through that meeting of the minds, and it does not require formalities of magic words after the offer or the sequence of communications.
But what was the regional manager? Is Robert Monk with National?
Yes, sir.
Regional manager?
Yes.
Testified the deposition? He did not offer UM coverage to Johnson?
He testified they did not use the words, I offer UM coverage, Your Honor. But also he testified...
Don't we take the clear meaning of the words that are used? He said he did not offer UM documents to the insurer.
In those terms, Your Honor, that's correct. He didn't say in those terms. He just said he did not offer it.
I believe, Your Honor, that his deposition had considerably more than just that one statement, and would refer the court to the face-to-face meetings and discussions with Rollins Burdick, the agent of the insured, with the memo that was provided to National Union by the agent of the insured.
Were to interpret that as that being incorrect, that when he said he did not offer uninsured motorist coverage, he really meant to say that he did.
I believe that the term offer is the crux of this issue and that the court is focused on that. And from the standpoint of the use of the word offer in the statute, which is perhaps the most difficult issue that is presented in construing the statute, that term is used solely in reference to the insured's option to reject.
But it doesn't say that 39.37.18, it doesn't say there must be a mandatory rejection. Rather, it's a mandatory offering.
Well, I think the key, Your Honor, is the word mandatory, and that is the focus of 39.37.18, not the focus on the word offer. If you look at both the title of the statute, mandatory, the language of the statute, shall be provided, cannot be issued unless provided, it's clear the intent of the statute is that it's automatic, as the courts have held by operation of law, unless rejected. The use of the word offer is the insured's option to reject that coverage, and that's where the offer comes into play. That's why National Union would respectfully submit, if you look at any offer requirement, it is the totality of the evidence as to the meeting of the minds. And this court, as well as our courts of appeals, have defined the standard for offer. And that standard is that which is required for rejection. Awareness, understanding, and agreement to reject. And that application of the statute then leads us to the conclusion in this case that we do have a valid rejection by Johnson.
You started out your argument and said that let's put this to rest once and for all. What is your strongest argument in opposing requiring that the express terms of the statute that it be in writing? Why do you oppose that?
Your Honor, if I may address that from two standpoints. My opening comment was that we should put the issue of offer to rest once and for all, and I think the way we do that is to hold that the statute provides for automatic coverage unless rejected. Then we turn to the focus on the rejection. And with respect to the requirements for rejection, first of all, I would respectfully submit to the court that the statute does not require that, and that you should not rewrite the statute in that regard. But even more so, the standards have been set for rejection by this court and other courts. They've already been discussed. And furthermore, the issue of rejection is no more difficult than any other issue that we deal with every day and that this court deals with every day. As Mr. Sanderson pointed out in response to one of your other questions, the requirement of a written document is not going to change the issues of rejection that come before this court. The court will then be confronted with adequacy, explanation, ambiguity, integration of documents, but far more importantly, the court should consider that the requirement of a written document and the timing of that document will have a serious impact on how this business is transacted. Much of it occurs on the last day as policies are coming up for renewal, and as a practical matter, it is almost impossible to get those rejections written or otherwise sometimes in advance of the actual closing when the binder issues and you're still working out terms, especially with multi-state national accounts.
If all those problems are likely to arise that you're discussing, why do you have a box on there that says rejected?
National Union did not, Your Honor. Lumberman's had a different form, and I would respectfully call to the court's attention, there's a marked difference between primary coverage and umbrella excess coverage. Indeed, of the various states, 28 states do not require umbrella coverage to afford UM insurance. 11 states have not even addressed it. Of the states that have, only 3 require a specific form.
Well, in the statute, 39.37.18, C treats it differently also. But the fact is that most of those forms, you're saying no umbrella policy has a rejection box?
There are various forms, Your Honor. They're virtually unlimited, and those states that do require forms usually require them by filing with that Department of Insurance, and the court is obviously familiar with the filing requirements of the various departments of insurance. But the statute is silent. 39.37.18c refers to a written document to change the limits or to ask for coverage after rejected. And I think that's significant, Your Honor, in view of the court's decision in Abate and Bartlett and all of the decisions, that neither the legislature nor the Department of Insurance has ever acted to require the written rejection. I would submit that the key here is to this dispute is between Mr. Jory and his employer, and as Judge Scow offered, that the message to be sent to the legislature is, if you want this protection in place, require the employers to put it in place. I can assure you the industry is more than willing to write the coverage, but our contract in this case simply didn't require it, and there's neither reason nor evidence to invalidate, which is an otherwise valid rejection.
Isn't the problem here that the statute as we have it seems to indicate that the General Assembly, certainly the statute doesn't seem to anticipate or contemplate this situation. It's really written for the vast number of people who purchase auto insurance and may not know about uninsured motorist coverage, and so the insurance company is required to tell them about it and then to have them actually reject it. Here, at the expense almost of form of substance, it's clear that the insured knew that they were UM coverage. It was a national company or did business in other states and had a broker that was a national broker. If we're to apply the statute very strictly, we do come out in favor of the plaintiff here, don't we? If we just take the words of the statute, offer.
No, Your Honor, I don't believe so. From the standpoint of the offer is to the named insured. Mr. Jory is not the named insured, and the named insured has the right to reject, and did reject. Significantly, Your Honor, the plaintiff has never, Mr. Jory has never, nor even factually here today, argued that Johnson was unaware, did not understand, or did not reject that coverage. Johnson did, in fact, and the evidence is overwhelming, by way of the discussions, by way of the documents which were prepared contemporaneously with the transactions, that Johnson was aware, understood, and rejected that coverage. From the standpoint of offer, we submit that the coverage is automatic unless rejected. We have here the rejection. If the court sees appropriate to impose an offer requirement through the statute, that requirement should be a meeting of the minds requirement, which is based upon the standards of rejection, awareness, understanding, and agreement, and based on the totality of the evidence, whether it be an offer of that nature or an automatic coverage by operation of law. We have an offer, and by the totality of the evidence, we submit that we have a rejection here. Therefore, National Union would ask the court to affirm. This is the Sixth District Court of Appeals.
Thank you, Mr. Janik. Mr. Holmes, you've used your time, but take 30 seconds if you'd like for rebuttal.
Quickly, if I might, I'd like to address the last part about rejection, page 1 of the reply brief. Question asked to Mr. Raines at deposition on the issue of the rejection of UM coverage on the umbrella coverage. Do you have any specific recollection of talking to anyone at Rollins Burning Hunter where you specifically rejected the UM coverage on the umbrella policy with National Union for the period November 1, 1990 to November 1, 1991? Answer, goes back, we have rejected through all policies. I do not recall a specific conversation dealing with National Union and rejecting just specifically that coverage with them. Clearly there was no offer, clearly there was no written rejection, clearly there was no rejection through the broker, clearly National Union should have UM coverage afforded in this particular case.
What about the issue that you initially raised, that this company told your client you have full coverage? Aren't they right that while a compelling issue is a red herring in this case, that's your suit against the employer?
Well, Your Honor, I think it's an inconsistent statement which goes to the credibility of the insured with regard to the rejection issue, and that's why it was used, not as a red herring in this particular case.
But the statements of your client can't really be held against the insurer.
The state, no, but the representative
of the corporation.
The representative of the corporation that made that representation either made it recklessly or knowingly, and in fact, that's why it was used as an inconsistent statement on behalf of the corporation for no other reason.
Thank you, Mr. Holmes.
Thank you.
Case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.